Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
You take this long-term industrial demand with silver and gold just from the industrial side that's embedded into the system, plus the decimation of all these currencies that our government and the generation that's in charge is willing to unleash, the opportunity may not be where the average person thinks it is right now.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and back with me again is Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Paul, I missed you last week.
I missed you too. So I'm looking forward to today and happy September to you.
Happy September. Can you believe it? It's September already. A little fall in the air up here. Markets are getting are starting to look a little weird, but we'll get to that. I want to talk about inflation today because I think inflation's coming back. There's a big philosophy out there. You've probably seen it that suggests that it could look like the 70s again. I think this rhymes, and I'll tell you why. It's an energy story. As well, we know the government obviously fibs about inflation all the time. So we got some nice stuff to talk about there. We have a housing emergency. I want to talk about that gold and silver. Can't go anywhere without talking about that. So a real target-rich environment today. And, oh yeah, I forgot. How could you forget this? Long bonds are screaming something across the whole developed world right now. Japan, Europe, U.S., something's going on.
Yes. A lot of good topics to talk about, and a lot of warning signs are being shot across the bow right now.
Well, let's just start right in. I'm going to peg this to energy. So first up, can we just admit something? Bob Elliott nailed it here. He said, it's just not credible for the Fed to claim to have a 2% inflation target when it's been 53 months above target and moving higher, and they're shifting now to more easing. And by the way, best meme I saw on this week was this one from The Simpsons. Go on, tell them. Inflation's only 2.7%. Look at this. They got here, Paul. This is same package. Beef loin, New York steak, boneless USDA choice from Kirkland, which would be Costco, right? Here we have it April of 24. Here we have August of 25. So a year and a few months apart. It was $49. Now it's $78.
Mm-hmm.
And we know why that is, right? Cattle prices exploding. I don't want to tell anybody I have cattle anymore. I'm going to have to fit them with GPS collars or air tags or something. I'm a little worried. They used to be cows. Now they're kind of like walking gold mines out there.
Yeah, leave the keys in your tractor and your skid steer because they're coming for the cattle.
Well, you just took a trip, and I heard that you had a guest along for the ride who was maybe a little shocked, hadn't seen things out in public in a while in terms of what things cost.
Yeah, so we carried my in-laws to the Colorado game in Boulder, Colorado. And I must say that stadium and Boulder, Colorado at Colorado University is absolutely magnificent. And wow, they had a heck of a crowd. I mean, their students that come out to that game were absolutely unbelievable. Other interesting facts we could talk about later, but this is the first time, and we were trying to figure maybe 20, 25 years that they've flown. So we carried them with my father-in-law is 81, and he does a lot of offshore fishing out of Savannah. So that's their thing. They don't travel that much. They go back and forth. And so they were blown away by the prices of things. I mean, absolutely blown away. And we're used to it because we've been traveling around. He's like, I had heard Colorado was expensive. But, you know, your nice little quaint locally owned restaurants and food's really good. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this food is good, but let's go to IHOP because that's a little bit cheaper. And then we go to IHOP and IHOP's just like ridiculously expensive. And it wasn't that they can't necessarily afford to do it. They've just not been out that much and shocked, you know, and how much security's changed at the airports. It was actually comical because we told my father-in-law to empty his pockets and he goes through the metal detector, and he looked like a magician pulling stuff out of his pockets. He's like, well, I thought this was fine. It was so hilarious. Even TSA was laughing because he'd pull something out and then he'd go back through. So, but they were, you know, it was actually really sad to me because, I mean, he was a traveling salesman in the furniture industry before it got decimated by globalization. So he traveled a lot, you know, up until probably around 2000 when he retired. And they were blown away. He could not believe how expensive things were. And so it's a little bit more expensive in some of those areas, but you know, it really opened my eyes to just how gradual, because we've, you know, traveled around, especially the football games a lot, to where it's shocking. It makes me feel, you know, it's sad for individuals to be traveling today that are on fixed budgets.
Yeah. Well, I remember my first shocking moment 2 years ago, first time I had $500 of groceries in a single cart, you know, just like, what, you know, back in the day, you know, $100 would like fill the whole cart, and, you know, it's been really shocking. And so this is shocking. Obviously, cattle prices, this is actually a tale of supply and demand. And I wanted to raise this because we're going to have a supply demand story around energy, because supply demand price, that's the oldest and most durable of all economics charts. First one you have to learn in Econ 101. There's a graph. You got your supply and your demand, and they cross, and price is the moving axis on that, right? It makes sense. You know, if there's too much demand and too little supply, the price goes higher, vice versa. At any rate, this is a story of somehow, because we had failed leadership at the USDA, our cattle herds right now are as low as they've been since the 60s. And obviously we have way more people, so on a per capita basis, just not that many cows out there. And the reasons for that is because the inflation has just crushed them. There was some droughts too, but hay prices. Paul, I'll spend $3,500 this winter trying to carry six cows, four of them dwarves. Well, they're not that small, but, you know, not super minis, but still 500-600 pound animals. But still, it's going to be just to carry them over the winter, right? So inflation's been intense. Meanwhile, the CPI has been telling us, oh, you know, 2.7%, you know. And when you look at this, the components here, headline inflation's the black line atop. Housing is the biggest part of this down below, which kind of makes sense, right? But look at food and beverages. It's like, this is not how it hardly has been growing at all, you know. Would your father-in-law disagree?
No, he would completely disagree. I mean, I would disagree, but he would be very vocal and probably drop a few expletives over that belief right now.
No, it's crazy what they say. And meanwhile, this was really helpful, you know, just to understand CPI is our inflation measure, consumer price index, right? And it's got three big, giant, stupid things they do statistically. I mean, there's liars, damned liars, and statisticians, right? And so BLS statisticians in that, you know, spectrum, they do hedonics, they do weighting, they do substitutions. Substitutions, for everybody listening, is the idea that if you can't afford those steaks we just showed you, you'd just substitute that with chicken, as if that was a realistic thing to do. So here you can see, Paul, that without the substitutions, obviously inflation would have been a lot higher, right? Obviously. Okay. But then we look at other things, like this is to your father-in-law's experience. They say, you know, the actual food inflation, they say, has been 31% since 2014. I disagree. I think it's been 31% since 2020.
Yeah.
but yeah, whatever, right? That's my personal experience. But look at McDonald's and Popeyes. All the fast foods have been vastly higher than the so-called actual inflation. Subway at 39%. Remember footlongs used to be like $6.99 or something, and now they're $17, you know?
Yeah.
So inflation's running hotter than we've been told, and people have that experience, and that's jarring, right? Because you have your own experience of it. You're like, since when did like Holiday Inn become a $300 experience, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. And hotel rooms are easily $500 in places that were $200, you know, 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the worst part, Chris. There's no love of the truth. There's love of narrative. And the bad thing is the populace is going along with it. They seem to be accepting this, at least for now, because the largest portion of the population voting base right now, being the baby boomers, are benefiting from the asset prices. They're benefiting from real estate prices, and they just don't understand the reality of what's taking place under the surface unless they're on a fixed income budget or if they're just tight. I mean, my father-in-law has the flexibility to do a little bit more, but I always tease him, they invented copper wire by pulling a penny out of his hand, right? So, I mean, that's not a bad thing, but most people are choosing to ignore this. They don't really understand what's taking place because of this constant deception of stripping from future generations to benefit the current generation.
Well, I'm getting bids right now, speaking of copper, on a project I have going on here. And one of the local plumbers, great guy, know him pretty well. But he was just saying that in his own garage, which he had to plumb up for something, he spent $9,000 on copper. And I said, wow, is this a huge project? He said, no. He said, 2-inch copper pipe was $9 a foot 2-3 years ago, $33 a foot.
Wow.
And this is for a guy who's buying wholesale, right?
Yeah.
But again, 2.7%.
That's 2.7%.
Not a chance. Not a chance.
No.
All right.
No way whatsoever.
So this was the thing that came out. There's this guy, Torsten Slok is a economist at Apollo, at the Apollo Group. And so he says, hey, you know, does history rhyme? It might, but you have two lines on here. One is the 1970s. This is from 74 to 82. On the right-hand scale, topped out at about 14% per year inflation. Put that in your retirement calculator. And then here on the left, we have our current green inflation experience. He says, wow, they kind of mirror each other. Is there a second inflation mountain coming? That's obviously things sometimes magically match and then just don't, you know, it doesn't play out that way. This doesn't mean it has to play out the same way. But, Paul, what do you remember what drove that second inflation mountain? In the 70s?
Inflation mountain in the 70s? No, I do not. I'm not.
This
exactly
is the oil
sure
crisis right here. Oil went from $3 a barrel to $33 a barrel between here and here. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of energy. So again, that price supply demand thing, we just had an oil shock. And so the price went way up because we had too little supply because OPEC withheld it. That was a geopolitical event, but that was part of it. And the rest of it was just money printing.
Yeah.
Lots of money printing.
We left that gold standard in 1972, you know, and basically since then we've had sustained
right there,
inflation.
Yeah. Yep.
But, you know, I've studied it a lot, but I can't remember the exact cause of that second wave. We're in a situation right now, Chris, though, that is a very important chart to pay attention to and to take into consideration. The debt ceiling's been raised, so the Trump administration has $3.8 trillion of extra fiscal spending that they can put through. You know, they're wanting the Fed to cut interest rates, and the market in general, at least a lot of analysts out there, seem to be just giddy that you know, we're getting ready to get into a liquidity super cycle. I mean, that seems to be the consensus out there from a lot of Wall Street. Is we've got, you know, everything that's coming together. So if we are getting this liquidity super cycle, and if you go back to, you know, Trump said that he was going to, you know, be fiscally responsible. And then all of a sudden that changed. We're spending ridiculous amounts of money at this point. They're talking about the extra firepower. They want the dollar to be lower. You know, Bessent comes out and says that interest rates should be 1% below where they are right now. It seems that they're doing everything that they can to try to kick this can down the road just a little bit longer. And they can justify it, right? I mean, there's many people that's like, well, as long as the other side doesn't take in the midterm elections, it's worth it in the interim period. Well, it may be worth it if you've got a lot of assets that you're sitting on and you're going to benefit from that. But what's it doing to the next generation? And if this continues, if that inflation comes back, one of the things that I've seen, Chris, is there is a lot of animosity building towards the baby boomers right now. Like I'm seeing this around the edges because there's a lot of judgmentalism about, well, you just need to work a little bit harder. Interest rates were 17% when I was younger. That's true, but you're still only spending about 19% of your income on mortgage payments at the time and about 17% on rents because they were lower. Today, this younger generation's having to spend closer to 39% of their income on a standard mortgage, and these policies could potentially make the affordability crisis even worse. So you know, yeah, I mean, that inflation coming back, I think if it does, and it looks like every policy that's being instituted or desired to be instituted with a weaker dollar, lower interest rates, and even what the bond market and gold's telling us right now, I mean, gold's breakout has been huge over the past couple of days. Silver broke out a month and a half ago, which is huge. And I know we talked about the big breakout that gold had like 2 years ago, and that's followed through. You know, so most of the indicators are telling us that it's a high probability that that inflation is going to come surging back.
Well, so there's real signs. You mentioned gold, but also I think bonds are telling us something. I want to get to both of those. But the first thing I want to get to, Paul, is again, a lot of what happened in the 70s was a story of energy, right? What didn't help. It wasn't the only thing, but it didn't help. So it was energy plus money printing plus coming off the gold standard plus, right? Inflation is fundamentally a loss of confidence in the currency. And so we look at that. Can we talk about this? So again, the BLS will tell us we didn't experience this much inflation, but this is what we have experienced. So this is a 35% increase in electricity costs on average over the past 3 years. And right here, at this little elbow right here, this is when ChatGPT launches. So I think you can sort of figure out what's going on here. We've talked about it. Mm-hmm. Massive data centers are going in. And so this is a big deal. So you mentioned X percent of a budget going towards housing. Well, 35% more is going towards paying electricity bills in just the past 3 years.
That's tremendous. I mean, that's not something that people have been used to planning for or preparing for at all.
Prediction. It's going to keep getting more expensive because we don't have any proper oversight or regulation in these markets at this point in time. So here's my thesis. Ready? So this just came out in Reuters yesterday, and there's a lot of colors on here. I'm going to just look at this chart here on the right very quickly, but this is global natural gas power capacity in the top 15 gas producing countries. This is, look at the increase from H1. Well, no, let me go to the blow up here. This is that same chart. From the first half of 2024 to first half of 2025, whoops, and a lot of this is the United States, is just this blue. So it says here that pre-construction of natural gas plants, power plants in the U.S. is 6 times larger than it was a year ago, moving from 15,000 megawatts or 15 gigawatts to 90 gigawatts. So I calculated it out. That's going to be about another 8 billion cubic feet per day of demand. And that's all in construction. It is coming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eight billion cubic feet. Oh, are we going to get 8 billion cubic feet more out of the ground? Well, not according to the Energy Information Agency. This is their projection of dry marketed natural gas production, and it's dead flat, maybe even slightly down for the entire next year from now.
Mm-hmm.
So where's that coming from? And by the way, Paul, I can't believe what I'm seeing. It's easy to find a $25 billion data center going in. And it's kind of mysterious to me because it's being put in by a company I've never heard of, like DataSource or what. They're like these little, like this, some of them just started up 2 years ago and they have this VC money just piling in from who knows where. There was one that was just announced in Texas last week, $128 billion is the planned build up.
Wow.
It's a 5 gigawatt data center. Like, okay. That's 5 Denvers, since you were just there, 5 Denvers of power consumption. And again, that power has to come from somewhere, and it's going to come from natural gas. So to the extent that natural, you know, all electricity is kind of, it's an energy market, so it's priced at the margin, meaning everybody pays what the last guy pays, right? You know, so if you have these things where all of a sudden, you know, natural gas is cheap now, but if it doubles, there's nothing the Fed can do about it. You can drop interest rates. You could raise interest rates. You could jawbone. It won't matter. The energy markets are going to have to price that gas at a level that balances supply and demand.
Right.
And that's a higher price.
That's a higher price. And with supply not increasing like that, something has to give. And that's the problem. In America, we seem to be, oh, it's a great idea, so let's implement it, instead of developing this longer-term plan and really strategically planning for the future. We're caught up in this instant gratification, and we're using up our margin for error. Yeah, natural gas prices are really low compared to what they were back in 2007 to 2000. Was it 2010,
11.
I think, when they cranked?
Yeah,
I'll have to go back and look at that. But but we're running out of these areas for margin for error. And at some point, it's going to come roaring back because we're not focusing on the problems from a long-term standpoint. And the market is misallocating capital because everybody's chasing the S&P 500 right now. Instead of going to where it should be going, it's just passive investing. Let's throw it in there because it's been working. And just the massive amount of marketing that Vanguard and the other index providers have put in there to convince people that passive is the right way. And it has been for a while. But there's no other area of our lives that being passive works really well from a long-term standpoint.
We mentioned it before. I don't have the chart with me on hand right now, but the percentage of the S&P that's contained in the energy companies is at an all-time low. I think it's like 2%. It's under 3%. It's like ridiculously low on a percentage basis. Now, if this is the near term, what is long term? Because they're projecting that data centers are going to create an 8% demand over the next 3 years on electricity consumption in the U.S. That's just in 3 years. And if this is coming from natural gas, this is from the long term energy outlook, annual energy outlook. And again, these things can be wrong and they change them all the time. I don't take this as gospel, but probably this dry market to get dry gas. Here on the bottom, we have either a low oil price or less oil and gas supply than they think. If that's the case, we go down all the way from here to there. There are most of their cases center about here, which is about a 10% increase. By 2050, we're going to have an 8% increased demand by right here, right? So, yeah. So it just becomes like, okay, where does that come from? Now, this has been kind of a lonely thesis for a little while, but Paul, Tavakasa just put this out. Are energy stocks quietly sneaking out? Are they quietly going to break out here?
It sure looks like it.
Doesn't it?
If it goes with the inflation thesis and the money printing, I mean, you know, you're seeing some big institutions move into precious metals, obviously, from your central banks.
Yep.
And I mean, that looks like it's poised for a clear breakout with the fundamentals that are driving it from behind.
Yeah, kind of looks like it. And here's part of that fundamentals, which is, of course, U.S. operating oil and gas rigs is now lowest level since COVID lockdowns. This is going to create a future supply shock because you have to drill the wells for them to produce. And again, Octavio Costa writing here, the decline in oil and gas operating rigs over the past 4 months has been the steepest since the COVID lockdowns. We are likely approaching an inflection point for energy, in my view. One, rig counts are falling. Two, inflation is picking up again. Three, bearish positioning in the energy stocks is as high as in 15 years. Sentiment deeply negative. Energy stocks starting to break out. So maybe drill, baby, drill wasn't as easy as it sounds. So now, if that's true, yeah.
That's an amazing chart right there. I have not seen that. That's absolutely mind-boggling.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just shedding rigs and experienced operators. They're called the frack crews that have to stand up. It's very complicated, right? There's 1,200 trucks will show up at a frack site to do the fracking. Obviously, you have all the truck drivers, but then you have very, very sophisticated crews of people operating these high-pressure machinery and you know, the choreography of it and everything. It's pretty big. So those are called, a whole crew of that would be called a frack spread. And we're shedding those really fast because nobody can make money at these current prices. So very little of that's happening. And once you lose those, Paul, they don't come back so easy. So now I think we have the setup. This happens if or when energy prices spike. It's not going to be immediate. I think this is going to take a little time, but we are echoing the 1970s again here, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. not just the energy price spike, which could be coming. Listen, inflation on electricity is already there. We're all familiar with that. People are lulled because gasoline is still pretty cheap right now, but that can change in a hurry, right? If or when something happens on that front. But what we see fundamentally is pretty clear. Over the next few years, this is going to, you know, be a monster that comes back. And again, look at this time frame. This started to pick up in 1978, a little bit more in 79, 1980. Started to fall back again. 81 wasn't until 82 that it really started to fall. So that's 5 years. These inflationary burns are kind of long fuses. So if the energy thesis I just laid out, if it just comes because, you know, we forgot to plan, we built too many data centers, they need the gas, but we need the gas, but we have these LNG contracts that are kind of locked, they need the gas, everybody needs the gas. Well, obviously, the only way you can square that circle is to have prices spike and kill demand.
Correct. And then as soon as those prices spike, with about a three-year lag, you're going to have all of these trend-following strategies that are going to jump right on top of it, mm-hmm. which is going to further exacerbate the prices and further exacerbate that inflation. So,
yep.
I mean, we've got an incredible backdrop because there's a lot of things to be concerned about when you look at just the S&P 500 and valuations. I mean, we're breaking all historical records and many of the valuation records that are out there. But you're ridiculously undervalued in a lot of the energy and commodity space. So, you know, there's opportunity out there for those that are patient. We don't know how long it's going to take for this to unfold because a lot of what's taking place is just herd momentum. That's kind of what everybody's chasing in the institutional management side and even your mm-hmm. retail investors. But once that flips towards that energy space and takes off again, you know, there's going to be a lot of damage on the other side. But for those investors that are paying attention to the fundamentals and the details and are willing to be patient, there is a tremendous amount of upside reward to protect your purchasing power there and help you navigate the chaos that's going to unfold as these shifts take place.
Agreed. Paul, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about how we can see this future already because there's a European hazard tale right there for us to look at. What happens when you forget to plan and let your energy prices spike? So we'll be right back. I know what's plaguing you. You feel like everybody around you has gone insane. Hello, Dr. Chris Martinson here. Look, we've built a world on cheap oil, endless growth, and borrowed time. But the cracks are showing. Inflation's up, resources are thinning, and the old rules don't seem to apply anymore. I've tracked this for years, from the crash course to today, and I'm not here to sugarcoat it. At Peak Prosperity, I'm your information scout, hunting down the facts, cutting through the noise, and showing you how to adapt. This isn't just information, it's a lifeline. The game is changing fast. Are you ready? Subscribe to Peak Prosperity now, and let's get ahead of the curve. That's my favorite sponsor, by the way, that we just heard from there. So I want to talk about this, a European hazard tale. We've covered it a few times. And Paul, this is possibly some of the biggest news I've heard in a while because war tends to follow pipelines. It's just one of the old maxims out there in the military space because obviously energy is everything. It is the master resource. It's power. So this was just announced. Huge news. Russia has finally signed a binding agreement, according to Brian McDonald here. This is true. Not just him. I found this is actually true. With China on Power of Siberia 2, it's a 50 billion cubic meter pipeline that's going to run through Mongolia from their Siberian fields up in Yamal. That stuff used to go to Europe. That was the stuff that got sent over and went down, came all the way down across here and down through the Baltic Sea, through the pipelines that got blown up. He says, unlike the current line, this one out of their Kotya fields, says, which taps Asia-facing reserves, this one diverts gas once meant for Western Europe straight into Chinese embrace. Gazprom has been courting Beijing for years to seal the deal. It's going to be a super expensive project. It's going to take, I think, 7 years to build. But now the pivot appears set in steel. So this is probably one of the most worst things that could have happened for Europe. And here's why. This guy who's got a Ukrainian flag, so he's looking for signs of, a sign of Russian capitulation. Haha. He said, capitulation? Look closer. Germany now pays 41 euros a megawatt hour for gas, where it used to pay 13 to 22. So they're 2x to 3x more for natural gas, which of course feeds into industrial processes. And, wouldn't you know it? Germany is very rapidly deindustrializing. Just a couple days ago, it was announced that another German automotive supplier closed its doors. The AE Group plants in Thuringia and Hesse finally closed. 650 employees out of job. And this is important, what I think Lord Bibo said here. This company is part of the supply chain of German automakers, hence it's indicative of the collapse of the German car manufacturing industry. However, the companies supplying the car makers are dying because there are less orders by the car makers. Now the car makers will need to compensate. Obviously, you still need the supplies of parts, right? So they'll have to compensate for the supply chain failure, which raises costs for them. Like, you can't just lose your, you can't lose your supplier chain.
No.
But they did, and the only thing I've seen German politicians do that was, let's say, proactive was they made it illegal for people to criticize migrants. That's where they're focusing their energy. And this is happening, and this is what happens when you have people who aren't paying attention and don't understand what's actually important.
And they're being out, they're being outwitted, outplanned for their own citizenry by China and mm-hmm. Russia to work around. I mean, that's hugely beneficial for China in the long term at the expense of Germany and Europe.
Daniel Lacall wrote here back in August, German GDP is a train wreck, investment falling a lot more than expenses than expected, government spending rising more than feared because they're having to offset that, consumption worse than estimated, everything moving in the wrong direction. So, Paul, have the bond vigilantes, are they actually still a thing? Is it a thing?
It appears to be the case for sure.
I don't know. Look at this. Yields on 30-year government bonds rising globally. UK, US, Germany, Japan. I could give you lots more. In fact, this was just on Zero Hedge this morning. Really nice summary they had there. The Bloomberg Index for Liquidity and Government Bonds, all of them getting worse. But the UK, really getting bad. They're having a liquidity. They're very close to a full-blown liquidity crisis there. And Japan, you and I have been talking about. This chart also on Zero Hedge, I did not know this, but this is kind of interesting. As Japan's 30-year bonds are blowing out, gold has been tracking it. So this, that raises the specter here for me, Paul, that, that what gold is really telling us is a little bit less about inflation and a lot more about the possibility of a sovereign debt crisis, which is a becomes very quickly a solvency crisis.
Yes. And I like that chart. I saw that chart a couple of days ago or within the past week.
Yep.
I just sat there and stared at it for probably 10, 15 minutes just thinking about the ramifications. Because if you look at gold that's moving, just, you know, if that's one of the indication on the 30-year and it's not necessarily fearing inflation yet, I mean, I think it's in combination with both of them. Can you imagine how much greater the performance is going to be when it starts moving over fear of inflation, not just the longer term yields going up, which yields are going up because why in the world right now would you want to tie your money up for 20 or 30 years unless you have to, or unless you're forced to from an institutional management standpoint, when we clearly see that all the governments of the world want to try to inflate this away. They don't seem to be scared of inflation in any way whatsoever. So if you're tying your money up for 20 or 30 years with yield curve control or, you know, inflation lies, quite frankly, the government's telling you that it's something different, then you're just going to decimate your purchasing power from a long-term standpoint.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have to be nuts. You would have to put a gun to my head to get me to buy and hold 30-year government paper right now.
Right.
Really? I'm going to get my $1,000 face value back in 2055? with 3%, you know, rate of return along the way, get out of here. But that's what's happening. And I just heard through Just Dario on Twitter looking that the finance minister of Japan is meeting with the Bank of Japan. They're having emergency meetings. And the theory is that this somebody in their financial system is blowing up. Somebody's just blowing out. Could be one of what they call their postal system, a big, you know, which is a pension insurer. Mm-hmm. It could be a big insurance company. Could be, but this smells like somebody's in a lot of trouble, and the Bank of Japan no longer has control over that because they can't. They just came out the 35th intervention. They came out and said, "Oh, we stand ready to buy any paper necessary," but the market is not cooperating.
No,
jawboning isn't working. They're going to have to do something more amazing. And that's why gold is blowing up, I think.
Yeah. And that's a different environment. And I tell you, I really have enjoyed just Dario's analysis. I mean, he's been warning for quite some time that we're going to see some banks blow up in Japan if mm-hmm. this continues to go. And it sure looks like it. I've actually been really shocked. Not surprised. Surprise would be a better word. Not necessarily mm-hmm. shocked that gold's broken out of its range here. It's telling us something is coming. We don't know what it is, but tell us something's coming. And So that's interesting. I'm curious to see. I have him in Possible Outcomes because his thesis that we're going to see a major bank failure in Japan is very well put together.
Well, in that front, and also putting together more of the inflation thesis, for whatever reason, we've talked about it before, but M2 money supply is just, you know, we're just like our money supply is back exploding higher. And it's interesting, the great financial crisis, nothing really happened. You know, the Fed did a little extra printing, but it created just, that was enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
Come on, this whole, now that we've learned the whole COVID fiasco, we now know that obviously they're trying to write these articles right now to say mistakes were made by the CDC.
Yeah.
Nah. That was a self-inflicted wound, right? We did not need to shut the entire economy down in emergency print because of a 99.95% survival rate overall. That was just a... mistakes were not made. Somebody did something. But we're back to seeing this, and so if you want to know why, like, stocks really aren't selling off, or Bitcoin's holding tight, or gold is going up, is because money supply is back growing at a very fast clip right now. I don't know how that's happening. I'm still trying to unravel that. It's murky to try and figure that out. Just murky.
It really is, because I want to know what the source is so that we can watch that. But there doesn't seem to be one individual source that's out there that you can put your finger on to say this is exactly where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But you can obviously see it in different asset prices, and especially what's, you know, silver starting to break out. Gold miners have been on a ridiculous run.
Yep.
And then, well, I say starting to break out. Silver broke out, consolidated, and broke out again. And then this bit, you know, gold's consolidated since... Man, I've got a chart in here if I pull it up. Gold's consolidated here for a while, so I'll pull it up here in a minute. You can talk about something while I'm looking for it. But there's a lot of warning signs right now that that's going to continue. And what we're seeing by Bessent and the administration is all of these ideas to continue to just provide liquidity. It seems that that's the only response that they know. And I don't think anybody really understands, if this inflation gets out of control, just how much of an equal opportunity bringer of misery,
mm-hmm.
how widespread the misery is going to be for the average individual. It's going to benefit the top 1%. It will, but it's going to, eventually there's only going to be 1% left, and the 99% is going to be hurt. And it's eviscerated the middle class for the most part
already
over the past 10 years. Yeah.
Yep. No, housing affordability crisis, stake affordability crisis, insurance affordability crisis. And the thing that bothers me about this, Paul, from a moral standpoint, is that they always try and talk about it as if it was like this comet we didn't know that came out of the Oort cloud and visited our solar system. Like, oh, look, inflation's here. It's an act of policy. Okay. It's an act of policy. This is what they do. When you decide as a government, I'm going to deficit spend $2+ trillion a year, you are creating inflation. When you decide to monetize that with a few little hooks and wiggles as the Fed, you are monetizing inflation. This is just how this works. It's very easy. And they're making the decisions. Like, we're willing. It's like, I feel like I have a Lord Farquaad, you know, Shrek moment here. They're like, well, a few million middle class families falling below the poverty line is a pain we're willing to suffer, you know, from their 1% loft, right?
Yeah. So detached and shielded from reality that they have no, they can't even have empathy for individuals because they can't possibly understand what it's like to walk in those shoes.
Mm-hmm. Proverbs is full of this cautionary tale. I feel like we're just revisiting some old human territory again here. But
right.
Well, so gold and silver, you know, I've been big fan of this for a long time. This is the consolidation on a long enough time frame. It doesn't really look like much, but you're right, we were consolidating most of 2025, to be honest. We had that one spike up, and then we had this rising wedge right here, and then a clear breakout, boink boink. Now we're, this is futures, not spot price, so as of this morning, over $3,600 an ounce. Which a lot of people go, whoa, $3,600 for an ounce. You know, Peter Spina of Goldseek flipped the chart and said, actually, that's your dollar collapsing, right? No, gold has not gone up. It now takes $3,600 to buy an ounce of gold, where it used to take
$300. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. That's a good chart. I like that.
Yeah, I like looking at it that way. And then silver had this very long consolidation between 20 and 30. Bouncy, 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 right? And then it finally bounced along that 30 mark for a while, and it became support instead of resistance. And then it entered this rising wedge, and now it's just broken out. And, of course, the big round numbers are always sort of psychologically tricky, but 40 was that big round number. But just sliced right through it, and here we are, and it just seems to be going up all the time. And I'm hearing lots and lots of stories that there's supply issues that are very bad out there right now. Meanwhile, if you look at silver on a longer term, what a thing of beauty. That's a beautiful long-term chart with my crudely drawn in blue cup and handle formation. But you can clearly see with that black dotted line, 35 was actually a critical moment to get past from a resistance standpoint now. So who knows where it goes from here? People have all kinds of crazy sort of like guesses. You know, is it 50? Yeah. Is it 70? Is it 80? Is it triple digits? You know, hard to say, but
it is hard to say, but that's a generational breakout right there of resistance. And that matters from a long-term standpoint, but that, cause that tells us that there is certainly a shift in the supply and demand, dynamics, because there's building demand. And the average person still doesn't really have any desire to buy at these prices. Oh, it's too high. It's too high. I can't tell you how many average individuals have just been saying gold and silver is too high, but they don't mind piling into NVIDIA because the momentum's there and they've got the herd comfort that's with them, but they're really just not paying attention to the fundamentals, because that narrative of, oh, you know, AI is going to change the world and NVIDIA is the answer from this point forward. But they forget that technology, and by nature, is always going to be an aggressive investment. Because what happens to NVIDIA if somebody, okay, somebody comes out with a better solution that's faster for less energy consumption, then overnight that demand changes to somebody new, where you take this long-term industrial demand with silver and gold just from the industrial side that's embedded into the system, plus the decimation of all these currencies that our government and the generation that's in charge is willing to unleash. The opportunity may not be where the average person thinks it is right now.
Well, you know, I'm constantly all over the energy story. So I get all these charts from the energy side. And this is a pretty impressive chart showing U.S. solar nuclear compared to China nuclear and solar. And China's nuclear is coming on like gangbusters. But you see this China solar? It's just like, this is actually a silver chart. This isn't, because silver is used so much in the solar side of things, right? Obviously in the panel construction. So when I look at this, I go, you know, we're going to have to take this into account. And by the way, saw this come out from Outcrop Silver. Good chart. This just shows supply and demand. Remember, we keep talking, Paul, supply, demand, price. I've been shocked that for the past 6 years, silver's been in this huge, sustained, massive structural shortfall. Much more demand than supply. So obviously the price should rise a lot. It didn't rise. It was like bouncing between 20 and 30. The whole time we were just locking in these giant structural shortfalls. And that's why back here-ish, I put out for my subscribers, I said, hey, not investment advice, but I've never seen anything like this. You know, silver at that time was $18 an ounce. And I said, this is going to have to resolve to the upside. Same story I think I have for natural gas. Again, what's the shocker in this? If a huge supply suddenly comes from somewhere, right? That could always happen. Got to be aware of that. You know, no guarantees of anything. But 1 year is kind of a bad thing. 2 years, okay. 3 years, now we have a trend. 4 years, this is a thing. 5 years, that's just, uh-oh, you know, what are we going to do about this? Mm-hmm. So we're going in, this is going to be our seventh year with a structural shortfall in a row.
Well, and what happens when investor demand for silver starts to move over there for protection of purchasing power, because they're going to pull it off the shelves. That's going to reduce the supply that's out there. And then at what price are you going to be willing to sell that back into the market? You know, there's going to be a price where it makes sense to diversify away from that. But the more money that starts flowing into that sector, the less demand is going to be available for that industrial demand.
What else happened this past couple weeks? You know who showed up on the 13F for SLV, the Silver Trust ETF? The Saudi Central Bank.
Seriously?
Is now one of the top holders of SLV. The Central Bank. Not a Saudi citizen or a Saudi domiciled hedge fund. The central bank. First time I've ever seen a central bank show up on a on an SLV prospectus readout.
Wow, I did not know that. That's interesting information.
But yeah. I think they should buy silver directly, but maybe they're not allowed to, you know?
Well,
just saying.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, why didn't you buy SIVR or something like Aberdeen that's 100% physical?
Yeah.
Or the Sprott that's 100% physical instead of having the derivatives contracts in there. So, hey, whatever. But that's a big deal that they're allocating in that direction.
Yeah, and we just had the USGS just had their critical minerals summary, and a couple new things snuck on the list, and silver was one of them. I can't believe silver wasn't on the list all these years. They finally put it on. I don't know what that means. It doesn't mean, well, Russia started a strategic stockpile of silver because they now know that if you're going to do these drone things and everything's about drones, the highest energy density battery we know about in the world is some version of a silver oxide, right? Could be silver zinc, silver manganese, whatever. Those are by far. So if you're going to really be doing drone stuff, you want a very light, high density battery. There's nothing that comes even close to the chemistry of silver currently. So
it's interesting. And it's fun for those of us that have been looking at the fundamentals, paying attention and willing to participate in those areas. And it took quite some time of patience to wait until you started getting some of these breakouts to allocate capital in those directions, as well as, you know, averaging in over time.
Yep.
But there's certainly a lot of upside potential there. But I do want to warn investors, it's not going to be just straight up and easy from here. There's going to be all kinds of volatility in that space. But this is one of those things where you do get those pullbacks, not a recommendation, you know, specifically just something for people to consider for educational purposes. When you do get those pullbacks, I think it's going to be important to buy those dips, just like it was important to buy some of the S&P dips over the past. That fundamental demand changes and the money's moving in that direction. Institutions mm-hmm. are starting to move. Big money starting to move in that direction.
Yeah, what do you do as a portfolio manager, a wealth manager, when you see a breakout like that in gold or silver?
Well, it depends. If you're seeing something that's a target in the portfolio, like specifically with gold, you know, a long time ago, back in 2016, after exiting in 2012, approximately somewhere around there, you get a long-term buy signal. It was pretty easy, though, when gold was back to $1,100 an ounce. It gets a little bit harder when you start consolidating. So one of the things I've been talking to people about is, hey, gold's been consolidating. Let me show that chart because it's a good educational point
here.
Yeah,
3,200 to 3,400. It just bounced for months. Up and down, up and down.
So if you take a look, so what I'm showing here is just gold. This is end of day. So this isn't pricing in today. This is yesterday. Spot mm-hmm. price going back to 2023. So this is a weekly chart, what we're looking at. So we had the nice breakout that occurred back in, what was that, February of, is that 23? And then the price moves up to here, and then you start consolidating. So that breakout was easy to allocate to. So you get in here, and this is a period of time where you're setting lower highs and higher lows. So you've got this wedge in place, and you want to average in, because there's a good chance that you're going to break down and test that 200-day moving average. So one of the things I've been talking about clients with, hey, this is not time to continue averaging in anymore. This is a time where we've had a clear resolution and a breakout to the top side. The weight of the information tells us that this consolidation period is over, and investors in general have decided that they're not waiting for pullbacks and price moves higher.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you have to act on those breakouts, specifically if the fundamentals are in line and it's a target in the portfolio. Now, just because something breaks out, if it's not a target from a relative strength matrix, we may not necessarily allocate to it. But if you're patiently waiting, averaging in is prudent so that you've got some capital available. So if you get a pullback, you can take advantage of that. But once you get these breakouts, you have to go ahead and act because the information has changed and you reached a decision point.
What was that bottom indicator on that particular chart? Was that a momentum?
So that's the price momentum oscillator.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite indicators.
Because look at it turn up there at the bottom, huh?
Yeah, and this is what's important, you know. So a couple of things to pay attention to on a weekly basis. Relative strength's down here at the bottom. So when you tend to be in a bull trend, you're going to reverse around that 50 on that, mm-hmm. that relative strength. And then we just kind of consolidated. Yeah, we broke a little bit below it, but we never got ridiculously oversold. So the price momentum oscillator, Carl Swinlan developed this years and years ago. It's just a stochastic indicator with a little bit different moving averages. exponential moving averages is what it has. You can see that this tells you, but now it started to turn up, it falls, and now you've got a clear move to the top side, which gives you an indication along with the breakout that we've got some momentum moving here. So last time we moved was in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, gold wasn't, you know, that led to the breakout, and then it consolidates here and we get that last final move higher. So I tend to average in when that thing's working its way down. And then especially when you break out of a wedge like this, that gives you a decision point. You've got this confirming relative strengths kind of showing a confirmation of the move. And that just gives us the confidence to be able to confidently allocate and know that we're making a prudent decision. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to if you have capital available in the future and it pulls out, but go ahead and allocate your percentage target to the metals when you know, to a position when it gives a breakout like that.
Let me ask you this then. We're going to change subjects real quickly and see if we can get through this in the time we have left. Did you see this? Treasury Secretary Bessent saying we may declare a national housing emergency in fall. We're trying to figure out what we can do and what we don't want to do, all that. There was no details. I don't know what that means to them or how they had planned to address it. For context, you and I have been tracking this stuff from Nick Gehrle over at Reventure. This is the actual housing emergency, which is housing market demand is near record lows for a bunch of reasons, but houses are just flat out unaffordable. So the emergency is house prices went too high for people to be able to afford them. And now markets are frozen all over the place. And we're starting to see actual, like, buyer capitulation. They're starting to like lower prices, not fast enough in some cases and all that. But the actual emergency was house prices got too darned expensive, I think. How could they address that? I mean, what's possible here? What's he talking about?
You know, my mind has been running in all kinds of directions since that news came out, but I want to show one other chart here that is also a good chart to pay attention to what we're looking at. So you showed the fact that market's frozen as far as sales. Mm-hmm. So this is dividendology, buying versus renting in America. So you go all the way back to the 1970s, you can see cost to buy was a little bit higher, but look at the difference here between the cost to buy on a monthly payment standpoint, the cost to rent, both of those have accelerated. So, I mean, this is the reason why the market is just frozen. I mean, quite frankly, you know, I got the thinking. So, and I went back and did a little bit of, I did a little bit of research. I'm trying to change my screen here, so bear with me. Grant Cardone is a real estate investor. I'm not that familiar with him, but I have heard the name. So he came out, you know, several years ago and said, because of the affordability crisis, we're probably going to see 50-year mortgages at some point in the future. So, you know, that's the first thing that came to mind is, what are they going to do? They're going to come, I mean, they're wanting to print money. They're wanting to throw interest rates to zero. They're wanting to break the dollar down. So what are they going to do? Come out and say, because of this emergency, we're going to put 50-year mortgages out there. We're going to change that. Well, what in the world is that going to do to the housing market? I mean, that unlocks a tremendous amount of demand because of the fact that most people, especially the younger generation, is so in debt from college and cars and the cost of living and wages not keeping up and having the purchasing power that it did before, all they care about is payment. So if that lowers the payment to the point, then now all of a sudden, yeah, it makes it a little bit more affordable from payment, but my gosh, you've got 50-year mortgages. I mean, this is insane. And then, but there's also a precedent with the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, back in 2023, they started doing loan modification programs for people that got in trouble and stretching them out to 40-year mortgages through FHA. So that's one thing that I'm really concerned about that they can put into place. Now, let me step back and give you a long-term picture before you move into another idea. I used to do a lot of water skiing years ago. In the 1990s, you could buy, you know, if you went to buy a boat or even a car, you couldn't borrow money for more than 3 to 4 years. Now, back then, price of a boat, we got them at cost from a sponsorship. So let's just say a Mastercraft ski boat was $35,000, something like that. Well, those same boats now are selling for $125,000 to $130,000. And you've got $400,000 wakeboard boats out there, $300,000 top of the line. But when I was at the boat show several years ago, because I've been out of skiing for for some time, you can get 30-year mortgages on these things. So you keep, I mean,
for an asset that depreciates in how many years?
Yeah,
boats don't last 30 years typically.
Ridiculously quickly they depreciate. So, you know, what have they learned in that industry? Easy credit, longer payment, you know, lower payments, longer terms is something that can kick that can down the road a little bit longer. So that's what I'm worried about it. I mean, I'll be heartbroken if that happens, but I'm also going to tell, you know, my daughter and some of those that are out there waiting, you got to move now. I mean, you just have to move because that unlocks a tremendous amount of demand for these houses because it does make it a lot more affordable from a payment standpoint. But it's terrible from a long-term standpoint on what people are going to be doing and the interest they're going to pay over that period of time.
Oh, no, that part's awful. But let me play devil's advocate. So, yeah, Trump's going to, like, get, you know, a very compliant Fed person in. They're going to lower short-term rates. But as you and I saw, when they first lowered those 50 basis points September last year, right, what happened to the long end? It went up. It didn't go down. And now we just presented data here today that the long end is busy blowing out, not just here in the U.S., but kind of everywhere. So I could easily see something where they start lowering rates and the long end goes the other direction. Why? Because they're just printing more money. They're going to have to liquefy that all up. So then what? You know, having a 50-year mortgage, it doesn't help if interest rates tick up 1%. It just wipes it out from a payment standpoint if you're just trying to gear towards a monthly payment. The only solutions are for houses to get cheaper or for incomes to go up a whole bunch.
That's exactly right. It's just a mismatch. And that's the thing. If salaries go up 30% or houses come down 15 to 20 and salaries go up 15 to 20, then you get a little bit more equal environment where it is a lot more affordable. But what happens to corporate profits at that point, right? What happens to inflation from wages going up? Are these corporations going to absorb that or are they going to pass it on down? So yes, something has to break. And there's so many ways that they could solve it. Just, you know, do you have to have a crisis? Just let the free market work itself out. The market's frozen right now. If we let this go forward and house prices drop 20, 30, 35, 40%, now it becomes a lot more affordable, right?
Yep.
It just becomes a lot more affordable. And get institutions and foreigners out of buying residential housing. That's another thing that they could do.
Yep. Well, as we discussed earlier, you know, yeah, it's always possible, too, that the government may issue mortgages directly to first-time homebuyers, say, and do it at cost, basically, whatever the government's borrowing cost is. Let's call that 4% right now. Interestingly, Paul, that would put first-time homebuyers on an equal capital cost footing with BlackRock and the other big institutional purchasers, because they don't borrow mortgages at 7.5% or 6.5% or whatever. They get money at the cost of capital for big boys, right, which is 4%. So they would be able to, you can't compete, right? They're going to just, they can make money at that still doing that. So maybe they could do that, but that would be kind of weird. We would be basically nationalizing housing, which is kind of an interesting, it's a weird thing. Well, let me put it this way. Paul, which government program led to costs falling for anything?
Isn't that like Bigfoot? Like, you know, supposedly it happens, but you never can prove it.
There's one blurry photo, but people can't validate it.
That's right. Not one anywhere, right?
Right.
I mean, go back to healthcare costs. At this point, we can look back. You know, Obamacare was supposed to solve healthcare, but all it did was reduce expenses, create profitability for Wall Street at the expense of the average individual. There's not one out there that has done so.
Yeah. Well, remember, so just to complete, there's one thread hanging out here I just wanted to tie up, is that the Trump administration threw away the top line. We're not going to control expenses. We're going to grow the bottom line. We're going to have our economy grow. On that front, here's the consensus forecast going in through, you know, and this is pretty... every one of these countries is now sort of headed the wrong way, sloping downwards, and spending more to try and, you know, get past that. And the United States just came out with a pretty hot reading for Q2, but I just wanted to digest that a little bit so people would understand it, because it's going to be trumpeted, so to speak, as this really great victory. But actually, if the real GDP change is clocks in at 3.3%, consumer spending barely above, investment clocking negative, government flat, exports. What happened is this is an accounting trick because GDP equals this plus this, but exports minus imports. Imports fell a bunch because of the tariffs, and that contributed 5+ points to the overall thing, which averages across all of these and gives you this headline. This is an accounting trick. That's declining imports is not actually the same thing as GDP growth, although that's how the formula presents it. I get why they do it that way, but I just want to be clear, like, oh man, the economy must be doing better than I thought. Why are all these people having trouble getting jobs? You know, what? Why are we seeing, you know, all these recession indicators when we have 3% growth? It's because this was an accounting trick.
Mm-hmm. But the average person doesn't know that unless they have somebody that they're listening to like you that's pointing that out. All they know is the news media in the evenings is saying, hey, GDP is greater than what it could be before. And in this environment, they feel a ridiculous fear of missing out. And it's like, oh, I got to get my capital to work right now. And it works in the short run. But when you're not paying attention to the rest of the story, I don't know why I've been thinking about Paul Harvey lately. Some of you out there will know Paul Harvey. It was when I was a kid, I loved the rest of the story. I guess that's just built in my nature. But the rest of the story is not as good as it seems. It seems to be we're in a world of nothing but propaganda at this point. Narrative.
It's true. It's true. So Europe's in trouble. Okay. And there's nothing they can do about that. They're really I feel sorry for all our European listeners. They have a tough road in front of them. But just sort of wrap this up today, Paul. I'm really worried that we have another big round of inflation coming because I don't see the spending restraint. I don't think we're going to have the top line growth that, you know, they want, you know, underlying growth they want to see. And we're about to have these energy inputs that there's not a lot we can do about them. It's kind of baked in the cake, right? If that happens, this is something I would advise people to keep an eye out for. If over the next 6 to 12 months we start to see energy really turn the corner, if we watch those XLE stocks break out to the upside, that says that this is a realistic possibility. And what am I talking about? I'm talking about $5, $6, $7, $8 a gallon gasoline. I'm talking electricity bills twice as high as they are today in the future. Things like that that, again, do not contribute well or positively to any affordability crisis we might be having in housing or otherwise. So to protect for that, obviously, I think you got to be nimble. You got to have your portfolio understanding where these pressures are pushing. There are ways to position yourself if this thesis is true. And just want to let people sort of stew on that for a bit.
Yeah, and there's ways to position yourself if the thesis, which I believe the thesis is true. But let's say it's two or three more years before reality comes home to roost. Okay. So what do you do as an investor right now? You got a couple of options. Most of Wall Street's going to tell you, you've got one option, passive, throw it in the index, trust us, and it'll all work out. Okay. I don't think that's a love of people, especially when you look at what this administration is doing, trying to open up private equity to 401k plans. I believe that's just a disaster that's going to ultimately hurt the average individual dramatically. People seem to be used for certain things, and that's why instead of loving us enough to give us the truth and the clear truth and the pain of the truth, they use us as a narrative to accomplish some goal. But you got a couple of choices. You can just be passive. You can hope that it'll all work out. You can stick your fingers in your ear and close your eyes and just hope that it's all going to be okay. Okay. But hope's not an investment strategy in any, you do the work and you put in the effort and you make the sacrifices and then you hope that you're rewarded because you can do all the right things and not necessarily get instant gratification or be rewarded in the short term. The other option, which a lot of people unfortunately will do, is they recognize that this doesn't make sense. They don't know how to navigate it, so they go all park in short-term treasuries or cash or CDs or whatever. That's the opposite extreme because the market can stay irrational far longer than you can stay patient or solvent if you're short this market. You know, that's another option. You can short it and you can go bankrupt in that situation. The problem with sitting all in cash and just waiting until you get this opportunity for it to arise is you're never going to get a perfect backdrop. It, it, you know, even if these markets come apart, you're still going to be scared to death that it's going to go lower because you're making that emotional decision. So those are the binary extremes. There's a third option. One, you got to recognize that you're not going to be able to navigate an unknown future perfectly, right? There's so many things that can go wrong. But if you have strategies in place that can help you be adaptive, that can pay attention to money flow, that can redirect your focus in certain areas, now all of a sudden, the investments that are out there, whether it's silver or gold or technology stocks or emerging markets or treasuries or long-term bonds, whatever it is, then that's a tool that you have an unemotional indicator that says, now it's time to pull this tool off shelf and plug it into the portfolio. That's what we did with silver a couple of months ago on the breakout. Do I think that the price is going to go higher? I really do. Is it going to be instant gratification? So far it has been, but volatility is your friend if you're in the right place, because that shakes weak hands loose. And you got to, I believe this is an environment that you have to be adaptive. We've reached a point that I'm reading analysts that I respect that they're like, hey, we're getting into a liquidity super cycle. Valuations don't matter. Well, they don't matter until they do. I mean, you go back historically and look at all these valuations. I've got one chart that I want to show here, which is representative, if I can find it. Bear with me just to see. Maybe it's the last one. Yes, I've got it here. So let me show this, Chris, just to look at the big picture. This is a point where you got to step back and look at the big picture instead of the tree that's in front. So this is bar chart. U.S. stock market hits its most expensive valuation in history, surpassing the dot-com bubble and the run-up to the Great Depression. Okay? So I know this isn't that clear, but you can see we've broken it here. Well, where are you better to be passive? In 2009, if you have money available and you're not fully invested at all times, your outcome to allocate funds aggressively in a period of time like this feels uncomfortable. But what's the market done since 2009, 2010? It's gone up a lot. What happened in the 1980s? Go back to the 1980s and think about that. Okay. You could buy a 20-year treasury back then at 16, 17%, actually, if not a little bit higher than that. And yeah, that did good if you held that over that 20-year period of time. But once that opportunity was gone by the 1990s, valuations were low and you were better off to allocate capital to the markets. So, you know, it's still a dangerous time. And I believe that you have to be adaptive, because the risk is, if you're just going to sit on the sidelines and wait, the risk is your emotions take over. You can't take it anymore. You subconsciously believe that this time is different and you pile all in at the worst time, right? I mean, that's everybody's fear. Or if you're passive, you know, you're hoping that these leaders are all going to work this out, but we're in a period of time from valuations historically. Yeah, it might last another 2 or 3 years. I could build the argument that we're going to shatter all the historical records for valuation. And maybe we've got this new regime of higher valuations, but you can notice that thing trends up and down. So even if it trends higher, there's going to be some pain at some point in the future. So I believe the most prudent path right now is to be adaptive, to be open-minded, to be disciplined, to focus on where you want to be 4 or 5 years from now, pay attention to the fundamentals, and make the best decision that you can with the information that you have today, and change your stance if the information changes. What was it John Maynard Keynes said? When the information changes, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? I'm sure I butchered that.
No, that's pretty close.
Essentially what he said. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's what we have to be. But I believe the worst advice that you can give to somebody is just passively allocate, stick your fingers in your ears and close your eyes, right? Everybody makes fun of the ostrich as it sticks its head in the sand. Well, that may work for a while, but you're not adaptive when the information changes in that circumstance. So that's what we do. That's what I believe, that you should be adaptive. And Chris, it's a rare breed of anybody that is adaptive and tactical in their allocation. Now, there are people out there, but they are a rare breed at this moment. And I believe those are the ones that are going to help people navigate the days ahead much better. It's not going to be without any bumps and bruises. And it's not going to test, you know, you're not going to be able to get through this without any testing of your patience and your discipline. But you got to work a strategy that gives you some adaptation for the world we're walking into, because things are changing. I mean, this is a major turning point that we're
so huge.
Either fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to live through. I think it's fortunate enough because I tend to be an optimist, and the prudent foresee danger and hide themselves while the simple pass on and are judged for it. So prudence is more important than anything right now.
Well, I have one more chart to add to that, wonderful sort of summary of this. The S&P dividend yield is the lowest since 2000. Now, why is that number, why is that year important? Charlie Bilello coming up with this one, but yeah, 1.19% dividend yield. So obviously people are not buying into the S&P for the dividends because you're getting crushed. If you're in there for the dividends, you are losing money, right? Because inflation's running a lot hotter than 1.19%. So we must be into it for the appreciation that's going to happen, right? And so that's a slightly different game. It's a speculative game. So then you have to know if you're speculating, like in housing, gold, any, you just have to kind of know where are we in this story, right? And just be aware that when you are speculating, you are saying, I know that I'm going to sell this to somebody else for a higher price. That's my plan. That's the plan right there, right? So at any rate, we'll see how that plays out. But that was just one more to add to our wow, stocks are expensive headline story set.
That's a really good chart. Yeah, because dividends shelter you if you move sideways for a period of time. I mean, you look at something like EWZ or ILF, which is Brazil or Latin America. Look, I know Brazil's got all kinds of issues out there, but you're getting a 7.5% dividend yield approximately. I don't know exactly what it is right now because it moves on a daily basis, but 7.5%. Well, hey, if you go sideways for 5 years, that shelters you for some income that you can utilize off of that. 1.1%, that's a completely different environment. And the problem is most investors are going to Vegas thinking that it's an thinking that they're making an investment. That's one thing if you go to Vegas and you know that you're gambling, right? If you lose, you set your parameters. I mean, I'm one of those that I'm not a gambler as far as, but I like to play blackjack. So I set my money. If I lose this, I'm done, right? If I double it, I pocket my money, and then I get really aggressive and I can win a pretty good bit of money if I get lucky. You know, you work strategy, but there's still luck that's associated with it. And most investors don't realize that the media, the money printing, the self-serving interest of the CEOs in America have turned the market into a casino so that they can extract money over the long term out of the pockets of other individuals back into themselves. And I want to go back to that quote that I saw. I saw it on X the other day, you know, and it was by Wisdom. I love this thing that they post, just Wisdom that they post on there. It says, people were created to be loved. Things were created to be used. The reason why the world is in chaos is because things are being loved and people are being used. And it's that love of money right now that's causing people to be used. And our job is not to be used or do everything that we can prudently do to keep from being used and surround ourselves with people who are like-minded. I don't want to be surrounded by a feedback loop, but what I mean is like-minded, that the greater good is better. We make investments in fundamental. We're looking for prudence and we're disciplined. We pat each other on the back and we encourage each other because we know that we're walking down the path of wisdom instead of the path of speculation.
Indeed. Well said. So with that, Paul, we're out of time. And anybody who's been watching this, if you want to talk to Paul or his amazing team, just please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a very simple form. Lots of people have been doing it lately. And somebody from Paul's team will be back in touch with you within 48 business hours to get the process started. And Paul, I understand you're pretty busy these days, so glad to hear that. But that means people are listening, and I think there's a little nervousness out there, which there should be. And I've noted that of the feedback I've seen, a lot of people just say, hey, I don't trust these markets, right? Something's wrong here. I don't get it. I want to be protected. I just don't want to lose. You know, what can we do? And of course, everybody's situation is unique to them, and no two people are alike. So that's why I love working with you and sending people your way, because you treat everybody as the unique individuals they are.
It's my honor. And we serve people, not money. And everybody's circumstance is different. And that's why the plan's so important. You know, we help them focus on what they need to do to be successful and what pitfalls are potentially there in the future instead of some arbitrary, you know, index. Because if you don't know what you have to do to be successful, then it's easy to get sold this idea that you have to beat this arbitrary index. And you know, that's great for raising assets for certain firms. Hey, and speaking of being surrounded by people that are lovers of the truth, which is the simplest way I could have said what I said, I'm looking forward to the summit next week, right? Next a week from today, I guess this will be out.
Yep. In a week, I'll see you up there and a lot of Peak followers. So very much looking forward to that. Always a good time. And it's just so relieving to be surrounded by people who are educated, informed, and most importantly, open-minded and lovers of the truth. Right. So,
yeah. So looking forward to it.
Likewise. All right. Until next time. Bye, everyone. And again, Peak Financial Investing, if you want to get that process started, I highly recommend it. Bye for now.